coming up on Philosophy Talk.
It's so easy to find examples of hypocrisy, and they're so colorful and so beautiful.
Isn't there a word for politicians without hypocrisy? Unelectable losers?
I think it is related to developing good judgment. Judgment not merely as a technical skill. Politics, morality, it can't be reduced to algorithms.
We live in a political world. Love don't have any place. We're living in times when men commit crimes and crime don't have a face.
Hypocrisy, vice or virtue?
The ultimate purpose doesn't matter. It bothers us because we want to think that we know people and know them well.
Our guest is Lawrence Quill, author of Secrecy and Democracy.
I am very, very happy that my private persona is inconsistent with my public persona, including the one that I'm currently putting out there, I might add.
Hypocrisy.
I think it's fundamental because the alternative is fundamentalism.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the Marsh Theater, the Bay Area's breeding ground for new performance.
Our thinking originates across the bay on the Stanford campus, where Ken and I are professors of philosophy.
Welcome, everyone, to Philosophy Talk. Our topic today, hypocrisy. Now, you know, John, there's a lot of hypocrisy around, especially in politics. But how bad is it really? Is it a necessary evil for an effective politician? Or is it really one of the worst things that you could be, a hypocrite?
Well, I suppose we ought to get started by saying what hypocrisy is. Now, the word comes from the ancient Greek, and there it meant playing a theatrical role. That's a preliminary stab. I'll say a hypocrite is someone who pretends to be something he's not.
You know, that definition sounds like a good start, but I think it includes too much, John. Consider a courageous abolitionist who, before the Civil War, who travels into the South. He gets there. He pretends to be one of the good old boys, one of the slave owners. His aim, though, is to get slaves so he can smuggle them up north and set them free. So he pretends to be something he isn't. That fits your definition. But would we want to call him a hypocrite? I don't think so.
Good example, Ken. The definition seems to need a little work. It seems to depend on what the person's motives are and whether he believes he ought to have the values he pretends to have. A hypocrite knows he ought to be one thing and pretends to be another. Presumably, your courageous abolitionist never thought he ought to adopt the values of slaveholders, so he's not a hypocrite.
But now I think your definition excludes some real hypocrites. I mean, consider a person who pretends to be an upright moral citizen for his own personal gain. Like some sleazy guy. He's going to volunteer at a soup kitchen. His real aim is to exploit vulnerable women he meets there. Look, like our courageous abolitionist, he doesn't believe in the values he pretends to have. In this case, pretending the poor. I think we would want to call that guy a hypocrite, wouldn't we? But your definition doesn't make him a hypocrite.
Yeah, but I think the definition's right and you're wrong. I mean, I think this guy is worse than a hypocrite. He's a cad. A cad and a hypocrite both have bad motives. And they both pretend to have good motives. But the cad doesn't even realize that the motives he pretends to have are better than the ones he actually has.
So now you've answered one question. If you think being a cad is worse than being a hypocrite, then I guess you'd think that hypocrisy isn't the worst vice that a person could have at all. But, you know, let's think about something else. Let's think about politics. Do you think hypocrisy is acceptable in politics?
Well, consider two politicians who both pretend to worry about the plight of the poor, but they do so in order to win votes. Neither of them really is moved very much by the plight of the poor. Now, one of them thinks it would be silly, immoral even, to worry about the poor. I mean, if you start worrying about losers, pretty soon you corrupt the whole body politic and twist it around for the sake of the losers, and that's not good. According to my definition, this guy, pretending to worry about the poor, is a liar and a cad, but not a hypocrite. Now, the other one, as I'm imagining, doesn't care much about the poor either, but he thinks he'd be a better person if he did. So he is a hypocrite. I prefer him to the first because there's some chance that the feelings he pretends to have will eventually take hold.
Yeah, see, I'm not convinced that the second politician really is a hypocrite. I don't think that's the right word. It sounds more like he just suffers from what philosophers like to call weakness of the will. In his best judgment, in his most considerate judgment, he thinks he ought to care about the plight of the poor. Maybe he even pays lip service to the cause, but he's too weak of will. He's too selfish to actually do the thing that he knows he ought to do.
Well, I admit he's got weakness of the will, but hypocrisy is a little bit more than that. It's his lip service to the cause that makes him a hypocrite. Were it merely weakness of will, he could admit that he ought to be doing more to help the poor than he actually does. But he doesn't admit that. Instead, he pretends to be doing something about it when he really knows, while he should be, that he's not.
And you think that's a good thing, you said earlier.
I never said that. I said that being a hypocrite of this sort is better than just being a cad and a liar.
Well, that's pretty faint praise, if you ask me. But look, John, there are clearly lots of great and difficult questions here. What exactly is hypocrisy? How is it different from lying, insincerity, or weakness of the will? Is it ever a good thing? And is there any way to avoid it in the real world of real messy politics?
Well, to help us think about this, we ask our roving philosophical reporter, Caitlin Esch, to investigate some famous cases of political hypocrisy, and she files this report.
I think one way to look at it is to think of democracy as a market for promises.
Ernesto Dalbo is a professor at UC Berkeley's Haas School of Business, where he studies political influence, corruption, and social conflict. He says American politics is full of hypocritical moments. I asked him to help make sense of some famous examples from recent history. Take this clip from the 1988 Republican National Convention. Here's a famous line from George H.W. Bush accepting his party's nomination.
My opponent won't rule out raising taxes, but I will, and the Congress will push me to raise taxes, and I'll say no, and they'll push, and I'll say no, and they'll push again, and I'll say to them, read my lips.
Those famous words were written by speechwriter Peggy Noonan. But for decades to follow, they marked Bush Sr. as a hypocrite. Dalbo says making absolute statements in politics can be dangerous, but effective.
Making these types of promises might be the way of politicians to signal to us that they have exceptional ability, that even when no one thinks this is possible, they'll have what it takes to deliver on something that seems clearly difficult. Or also, it might be a way of signaling to us that they truly care about, say, not raising taxes, and therefore they're willing to make the costly investment of holding themselves up to a standard that if they are to violate later on, we'll be angry at them, we'll think that they lied to us.
Our next example involves a Florida congressman who resigned in disgrace in 2006. Representative Mark Foley was caught sexually harassing teenage boys. Here's a clip from ABC News.
In Congress, Foley was part of the Republican leadership and the chairman of the House Caucus on Missing and Exploited Children. He crusaded for tough laws against those who use the internet for sexual exploitation of children.
They're sick people. They need mental health counseling. They certainly don't need to be interacting with children.
So here's a politician who takes an active stance against child pornography coming on to underage boys. It seems like the pinnacle of hypocrisy. Again, Ernesto Dalbo.
So this is a person that has a weakness, an important one, and he legislates against people with that weakness, which includes himself. So as horrible as the case is and as disturbing as it is, I think if we were to rescue anything of value or positive about human nature from it is this duality that we have. That is, we know we have weaknesses, and we also strive to create rules that contain them.
And our final example. In 2010, former Senate Democratic leader Tom Daschle got in trouble for not paying some of his taxes. Here's a clip from Sean Hannity's Fox News show. Hannity reports Daschle failed to pay $140,000 in Medicare payroll taxes.
But it gets worse. In 1998, while Daschle was a member of the U.S. Senate, he said the following on the floor during the debate over the Internal Revenue Service Restructuring and Reform Act. Quote, "We make no mistakes about it. Tax cheaters cheat us all, and the IRS should enforce the laws to the letter." Who knew he was talking about himself?
Here, UC Berkeley's Ernesto Dalbo says the infraction seems to be minor, a mistake maybe, but the Dashiell example evoked outrage because it violates the basic principle of fairness.
People say, well, you know, these people are asking us to respect these rules, but they do not internalize these rules themselves, and that seems fundamentally unfair.
Americans hold public figures to higher standards. We expect them to live up to the ideals they promote. And when they make mistakes or lie to us, we tend to forget they're only human and still politicians. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Caitlin Esch.
Thank you, Caitlin. Thank you, Ernesto. What a great line. Democracy is a marketplace of promises. Write that down. It could be the title of a book. I'm John Perry, along with Ken Taylor, my fellow Stanford philosopher. We're here coming to you from the Marsh Theater in Berkeley, California.
And we're joined now by Lawrence Quill. Lawrence is a professor of political science from San Jose State University. He's author of the forthcoming book, Secrecy and Democracy. Lawrence, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Lawrence, we tried to get a real hypocrite for the show, but Newt couldn't come. So we settled on a non-hypocritical specialist on hypocrisy, and that's you. Now, you write about a lot of topics in political science. What drew you to hypocrisy in particular? Was it local, state, federal politics, university politics?
I'm not going to touch the last mention there, but I was drawn to hypocrisy, I think, because there's a lot of it about. It's so easy to find examples of hypocrisy, and they're so colorful and so beautiful.
So Ken and I, in our intro, tried our hand at a working definition of hypocrisy. I'm sure you can do better. What's your definition of hypocrisy?
Well, I'm not sure that I can, but why don't we start off with something like this? We could say that hypocrisy, in the simplest level, is saying one thing and doing another thing. But in addition to that, there's also an inconsistency that we apply to the hypocrite in terms of behavior and character. And I think that's something important that we might want to focus on.
So saying one thing and doing another thing. Okay, I could say one thing and believe another thing, then I'm lying. Mm-hmm. I could say something that I don't mean, I'm insincere, maybe I'm not lying, that I don't really believe. I may not intend to deceive you, but saying one thing and doing another, like saying this would be the best thing, but doing something else. Mm-hmm. We wondered about the difference between, say, hypocrisy and weakness of the will, where you think this is the best thing, but you just can't bring yourself to do it because you're overcome with selfishness or fatigue or something. Mm-hmm. In terms of the vices and failings of a human being, how do you locate hypocrisy among these other ones?
Those are all good points, and I think all of the key terms that you referenced there are related to hypocrisy, but we might want to think of it like this. The hypocrite may not necessarily believe in the end goal that he or she advocates. So in point of fact, the purpose, the ultimate vision that the hypocrite talks about and espouses may not matter. They might be advocating a position simply because they want to get reelected or they want to gain more friends on Facebook or something like that. So the ultimate purpose doesn't matter. It bothers us, and this might be as much our fault as it is theirs, because we want to think that we know people and know them well.
And we want to take their words as an indication of what they believe, what they're aiming at, and when you say one thing and do another, we can't do that. John, you want to do
that? Well, a famous example is Thomas Jefferson. Mm. Now, Thomas Jefferson wrote a lot that indicated he really understood the injustice of African-American slavery. And yet, he never freed his slaves, and he probably kept an affair with an African-American woman secret. Hypocrite or just anguished, weak-willed, complicated guy?
I'm not really sure it matters, actually. I mean, if we're going to lump Thomas Jefferson in there, we might as well include everybody else that was around at the time that was also a fabulous philosopher, enlightenment wit, founding father. All of them owned slaves. Most of them regarded slaves as property. They bequeathed these properties to their descendants and so on and so forth. It doesn't detract from the fact that they were very, very good politicians. They wrote that constitution of yours after all, didn't they?
Well, the anguish weak-willed guy is different because he sincerely believes in the thing that he can't bring himself to do. I think the hypocrite is the person who says the thing he doesn't really sincerely believe or doesn't intend. I mean, and the thing that he does is what he's really after. So I think that's a big difference between the anguished, weak-willed person and the hypocrite. But you know what? We'll dig into which is better and which is worse and all that sort of stuff in a bit. This is Philosophy Talk, coming to you from the Marsh Theater in Berkeley. We're discussing hypocrisy with political scientist Lawrence Quill.
Now that we've got a bit clearer definition of hypocrisy, we can ask whether it's always a bad thing, sometimes a bad thing, sometimes a good thing, in some situations a positive thing.
The good, the bad, and the hypocritical, along with questions from our audience when Philosophy Talk continues.
I want cheese on a stick, thinks the gastronome. I'm a minimalist at the Astrodome. I hate kitsch, I got a garden gnome. These are the perks of hypocrisy. I'm an anarchist with a government plan. A spoiled little child who says he's a man. I'm a hipster with a farmer's tan. These are the perks of hypocrisy. Don't get so analytical, it's only hypocritical. These are the perks of hypocrisy.
Thanks to our musical guests, the Playtones. This is Philosophy Talk. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're thinking about hypocrisy with political scientist Lawrence Quill.
Have you ever felt the person you were talking to was being hypocritical and admired them for it? Have you ever engaged in hypocrisy in the service of some higher good, in the service of some lower good? Join the discussion by stepping up to the microphone.
So, Lawrence, a lot of great moral thinkers have actually advocated hypocrisy on some occasions. Sir Thomas More, for example, said that one needs to be economical with the truth in order to do good things in the public sphere. I don't find myself believing that, really, but I wonder, do you think that hypocrisy can ever serve a higher good?
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Yes. Come on, defend that view. You can't just leave it at that.
No, you're probably right.
You really believe that, or you just say that?
Yeah.
How would you know the answer to that question? You just have to take my word for it, unfortunately. No, I think that hypocrisy absolutely serves a purpose. You mentioned Thomas More. Thomas More did say that you had to be economical with the truth, and very, very good advice that was as well, though we all know what good it actually did him because he lost his head, poor chap. But the idea was that you have different audiences that you have to appeal to. You can talk, he said, academic philosophy to other philosophy types. But when you're going to talk to a powerful person, and this is where it does get very tricky, you have to use what he called civil philosophy. In other words, you have to be careful what you say. You don't want to upset them. You're probably going to flatter them. You're probably going to be economical with the truth. You're going to bend things a little bit so they can be persuaded.
I grant you there's a kind of utilitarian thing when you're talking to a powerful person who doesn't really want to hear the truth and has the capacity to, reward you or punish you for what you say to that powerful person, then you ought to tell the powerful person what they want to hear, even if you don't believe it, even if you don't intend to act on it. Yeah, but that's expedient. That's not a good thing. I mean, the powerful person shouldn't be so oblivious to the truth. So, sure, sometimes it can be expedient to be hypocritical, but is there anything ever more than expediency? Is there actually virtue in being hypocritical?
Yes, ever? There is. Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Well, you haven't shown me that. You've told me a case in which it's expedient to be hypocritical.
Well, just give me time. Give me time working up to it.
Right. Let me throw in a case. So suppose you're on your side here.
Ah, good.
So you're an introductory philosophy teacher, and let's suppose that you're a complete atheist, and you're not only an atheist, you think the arguments of the existence of God are just so much blather. Oh. The Bible is just a bunch of words that got thrown together to a historical accent, so forth and so on. But you're teaching introductory philosophy, and students come up to you and say, well, do you really think it's stupid to believe in God? I think the right thing to say is, a lot of intelligent people have believed in God. There's some very interesting arguments, and you should make up your mind after considering them. Now, that's hypocritical in a sense, but surely that's what I should do. How do you like that one?
I like it very much. Yeah. No, you're being a professional. I think that's what you're being. You're adopting a certain role, pursuing a particular standard behavior that is different from how you might behave behind closed doors. At least I sincerely hope so. Because what you're doing is you're thinking about your audience. You're also in a mentoring role, we might say that, and so on and so forth. And I think it's very similar with very clever advisors to not so clever politicians. You can't push politicians too hard, too fast. They've got a lot on their mind. They have to look good for camera. They have to appeal to, in this country, what is it, 350 million lunatics? I mean, citizens, on a regular basis. I mean, that's a terrible job.
Let's slow down. I know politicians are a complicated thing. I think about the atheist professor teaching students in the Bible Belt. I don't see that as hypocritical. I see that as being a good teacher. And part of being a good teacher is sort of adopting your students' point of view, giving them what they're ready for and on the times in which they're ready for it. It's not all about you, right? It's not all about you and your aims. You're not telling them in order to manipulate them or anything like that, right? I mean, if I were asked by that student, I would say, let's keep my beliefs out of this. Let's ask, what's a good argument? How would we go about thinking about this? And that's what I'm trying to invite you to do sphere of dialectical give and take.
Well, so maybe you wouldn't be a hypocrite. I probably would, because I think if I keep my beliefs out of it, that's like saying, I'm an atheist kid, don't push it. But I wouldn't do that. And I am manipulating them. I'm trying to get them into reading and thinking. I'm manipulating them for a higher good. But my actions, in this case, my verbal actions, are not dictated by my beliefs.
I agree. I think the manipulation, even though we don't like the sound of that, we're all coerced to some extent. I'm glad that I was coerced by my parents so that I could behave in a reasonable way when I went out in public as a young person.
But I want to ask you,
I get to ask you a question. You're a baseball coach, right?
Uh-huh.
Now, so these are smaller kids, and they come up to you and they say, Mr. Taylor, is there any hope that I'll ever be a good hitter? And you say, let's leave my beliefs out of it.
Well, I tell them what it takes to become a good hitter. I tell them things you can't teach. You can't teach bat speed. If you've got a slow, lumbering bat, I say, look, this is what we're going to have to do to get you. You've got to shorten your swing. And about, you know, I diagnose what they can and can't do. But I want to ask you both a question. Okay, you gave me a case of good hypocrisy where you think it's permissible. Give me a case where it's not permissible. And I want to know what the difference is. Because I think the only thing you guys are going on here is mere expediency. But tell me a case where it's not a good thing, and we'll diagnose what's the difference between the good-making cases and the bad-making cases.
Right, yeah, I think a bad case of hypocrisy occurs when the person who is the hypocrite forgets that they're being a hypocrite. So in a sense, they start believing their own press. Now, when that starts happening, when they start believing that they're a very sincere, decent, truthful person, when in fact they're nothing of the sort, then, of course, they can get themselves and other people into all sorts of trouble.
But that sounds like only the sort of self-deluded. The delusional hypocrite is the bad hypocrite. So if you're a clear-eyed hypocrite, it's all right?
A lot of hospitals and universities have been built with money from hypocrites.
I mean, look, Ken, the thing is, it's a little complicated. Let's take the congressman who was molesting the intern while advocating laws to keep children safe from people like him. Now we say, was it a good thing for him to be a hypocrite? Well, depends on what the baseline is. Given that he was molesting the kids, was it better that he advocate these laws? Yeah, better than doing nothing, at least. Given that he's advocating the laws, that doesn't make him a hypocrite. Is it better that he became a hypocrite by molesting the interns? No. Right. So it just depends what you're starting and what your finish base is, whether it's a good thing to be a hypocrite.
He's a complicated case, because that's more, I think, more like weakness of the will. I mean, the fact that he promoted these laws and his career on it means that at some level he believed, you know, molesting children was wrong. Probably he felt guilt and shame and remorse, but he couldn't stop himself. It was like an addiction or something like that. I don't think that's hypocrisy. That's weakness of the will, and that's a terrible thing. That's a terrible psychological turmoil that a person can have. But I don't think hypocrites go through the same psychological turmoil. I wouldn't dignify something, hypocrisy. I mean, something that doesn't involve that same kind of psychological turmoil, I wouldn't dignify that. Well, that's more like weakness
dignify
of the will.
Dignify.
Yeah, well, dignify is not the point. Right.
Let's go back to my example of Jefferson. I mean, he wrote. He didn't, like Washington, those guys, just not say much about it. He wrote about the injustice and how there's a special place in hell reserved for us, and we probably ought to ship all the slaves back to Africa because once they figure out what we've done to them, it's going to be horrible. So he realized it with a clear eye, and yet I assume at some level he wanted to free slaves. Other slaveholders would free their slaves and stop by his place in Virginia on their way to the north to shake his hand. How must he have felt when that happened?
So that's a torn kind of person.
Well, that's a torn person, but I think if you just don't want to, if you want to say, oh, well, then he's not a hypocrite, you're just saying, well, because he's interesting and morally complex and he's Thomas Jefferson, he wrote the Constitution, we don't call him a hypocrite. He was a hypocrite.
Let's get some questioners in here. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about, with Lawrence Quill, about hypocrisy. We've got an audience here at the Martz Theater full of non-hypocritical listeners. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
I'm Richard Moore, and I think the more self-aware we are, the more often after the fact we perceive hypocrisy within ourselves, and we're talking about the psychological aspects of hypocrisy and pathological lying and the slippery slope of being in public and putting on a certain persona and being a little bit of a chameleon and slipping into another role. And we unintentionally or maybe perversely misrepresent ourselves in our own thinking. I think it's just a very slippery slope of being a public person.
I think there's something deep and important in what you're saying, and I think it goes to with what's wrong with hypocrisy almost always. You know, I grant these experiences, because here's the thing. Public person, we're all public persons. That is, we all have public presentations to our fellow citizens of what we are, what we believe, what we value. We live our lives together, right? We deliberate about what we should do together, about what we shall be together, what we owe to one another. If you're representing yourself to me as one thing, but being something else, then that very thing of our shared life is deeply undercut. It's not supported by that. That's acid to our shared lives, not a support of our shared lives. What do you think about that thought?
I couldn't be more wrong.
Couldn't be more wrong? Really?
No. You describe Facebook society. You described a society that's almost completely superficial, where we represent ourselves, we put ourselves out there pretty much all the time, and that might be inconsistent with our inner lives. I am very, very happy that my private persona is inconsistent with my public persona, including the one that I'm currently putting out there, I might add. All right, precisely because I think that there is a danger with hypocrisy, and that's the kind of the anti-hypocrite stance. The anti-hypocrite stance, which, forgive me, I think you're probably channeling quite effectively here, suggests that there is a way to determine exactly what a person actually is thinking or is in a deep sort of philosophical sense. And I think that that's a piece of moral confusion that we all play with and that we can't escape from. We talked earlier about the Greeks and how the Greeks and the original definition comes from acting and presenting oneself. We are also, in a complicated way, a Christian nation, and Christianity is very, very clear about the hypocrite. The hypocrite is not really a hero for Christians. The idea that comes from Christianity is that there is an inner life, there is an inner core of a person that is somehow true. In the modern world, that transforms itself into a phrase that comes from Rousseau called authenticity. Right. There is the authentic person there. Pursuing authenticity, as we know from experience now over the past 250 years or so, can lead to devastating, terrible things. So I think we have to be very careful about judging other people as hypocrites. If we judge them as such, in good fun, haha, you're a hypocrite, and leave it at that, that's okay. But how can you ever know for sure that you're being told the truth?
So is this kind of like a English-French thing we're walking into here?
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Well, the French are into authenticity, I think you're suggesting.
Yes, right. Right.
Well, let's get some more questions from our live audience. Welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Hi, my name is Diane Milner. I'm from Oakland, California. The late Senator Strom Thurmond was an ardent segregationist, yet he fathered a child with his African-American household maid and, in fact, had correspondence with that child over a number of years. Where does he fall on the hypocrisy spectrum?
Well, I would never call anybody a hypocrite, certainly not to their face, and certainly not after they've sort of left office. But we could just say that he's a very complicated character and a person that has the ability, as many of us do, to compartmentalize our priorities. That's where I'd put it.
I'd say he was a bad hypocrite, who's kind of the model for the negative feelings Ken has towards hypocrites.
I'm trying to figure out what you think about this. I mean, you didn't quite diss, but you said authenticity, I guess as a single-minded pursuit, is a bad thing. I suppose you also think the same kind of thing about a kind of transparency, that what I represent, what I am, I represent myself as to people, and what I represent myself as, I am, right, to people. And I think in certain kind of things, like in my family, in my married life, in the spheres of intimacy, a certain degree of transparency is demandable of me. Is perfect. Now, less transparency is demandable in, you know, in my job, but there are degrees of transparencies that are morally required of me. And I don't know if you accept that or reject that or what.
No, I think that that's fine. I think it's important to keep the private and the public separate as much as we can. And I know that's a very tricky philosophical distinction and so on and so forth. But publicly, as in being a politician, being somebody that has a public role, I think what we have here then is a different kind of morality at work, one that makes the way that we judge the performance of individuals different from how we might judge a person in their intimacy or in their private life. So I would agree with you. Good heavens, I can't believe what's going on. I'm actually in agreement with you over this point. But I'm saying that politics operates by a different set of standards.
Right. So that's really professionals in general, but in particular professionals in politics, where you think hypocrisy has a positive role to play.
I think it's fundamental because the alternative is fundamentalism.
We'll take that up. Let's get one more question here before the break. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
Thank you. My name is Benjamin Kimmick from Berkeley, California. My question relates to the motives of hypocrisy. So, for example, let's say that there's a particular politician that knows he can't get elected unless he advocates for not raising taxes under any circumstances. But let's say this person's very familiar with the economy and knows that there's no way that without a certain amount of diplomacy you can get anything done in Washington. So he says to his constituents, knowing that it's the only way to actually get elected, that he would never raise taxes, knowing full well that when he gets there, that he's going to have to actually, you know, possibly do that. And then let's say 5-10 years later, someone looks back at that, and his decisions were correct. You know, GDP went up, you know, the economy started to get better, jobs, you know. Let's say that, you know, in that case, it looks like he made the right decision and he was correct. But he had to lie to his constituents to get there. Is he a hypocrite?
I think he's an effective political leader who had a good bit of luck. If only they were all so lucky, for goodness sakes.
By your lights, he is a hypocrite, but that's not a bad thing. I mean, the problem that Lawrence is having, I think, is that we want to use hypocrite in our ordinary discourse as a term of condemnation. He agrees with the definition roughly that we gave, but he doesn't want to use it as a term of condemnation. He wants to turn it into, at least in the political sphere, a term of praise. There's a certain skill, there's a certain virtue that you have as a politician when you display this trait as a hypocrite.
Take our beloved president. I mean, you know, he hit on a winning strategy, convinced people that if you're elected president, there will be a new age of camaraderie in the Congress and the blue states and the red state distinction will disappear. He knew that wasn't going to happen. But what was the alternative? Not come up with a winning strategy and let a nutcase from Arizona become president? Of course it was the right thing to do.
That profound note. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're thinking about hypocrisy with Lawrence Quill from San Jose State University.
We expect our political figures to be hypocritical, just as we expect them to eat hot dogs, kiss babies, kowtow to rich donors, and profess their love for America. Is hypocrisy a necessary part of our political system? If so, is it a necessary evil?
We're coming to you from the Mars Theater in Berkeley. We'll take more questions from our live and lively audience when Philosophy Talk continues.
Hypocrite convention at a very fine hotel, where every bad intention stays safely in the shell. It's the hypocrite convention, but they don't call it that. There is no need to mention the balloons and funny hats. It's the hypocrite convention I think you should attend. You can say not do till the cows come home, until the bitter end, until the chicks come home to roost, at the very bitter end.
Thanks again to our musical guest, the Playtones. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. Today, it's Hypocrisy with our guest, political scientist Lawrence Quill. We've got more questions from our live audience. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
Hi, my name is Andy Hansen. I'm from San Francisco, California. My question is kind of an observation that I've had since I've been sitting here today. I think when I came here, I thought of hypocrisy as a negative thing. And as we've had a discussion and heard you guys talk today, that now I'm perceiving it as actually something positive. You have the ability to think of something or and believe something, and then you have the option to act on it. And if you think that what your feelings are actually wrong, then you can act differently in the public to be more virtuous or idealistic. And so my question is, do you guys actually think hypocrisy is a good thing?
Well, I don't. I mean, I think it may be an expedient thing, but I don't think expedient is good. And moreover, it may be that it's a solution to a problem in a political. Let's think about the political system. I mean, I love democracy. I'm a big, huge fan of democracy. I think of democracy at least as aiming at something like this. Here we are all citizens with our diverse interests, our diverse beliefs, our diverse values, and we commit ourselves to deliberating together about what we should do together, how we should govern ourselves, deliberating together without weapons, right, without dividing into army, deliberating together by procedures we all endorse so that we have outcomes that we all, even if we're not happy, we accept that it was a fair, principled decision-making procedure, and then we can fight it out the next time. Now, if I hide from you my motives, if I'm open with you about my values and my reasons, then, you know, when we're deliberating together, you feel like I'm a fair partner in that sort of thing. Hypocrisy, you know, saying one thing and doing another, and saying one thing and valuing another, undercuts the very idea of that collective deliberation. That's like having a norm of lying and deceiving rather than a norm of truth-telling. So it might be expedient for a leader who wants to manipulate us and you know, who thinks we aren't up to serious deliberation together. I mean, that's Plato's noble lie. You know, of course, the people aren't up to serious deliberation together.
And you seriously believe this? You're not just saying this because best thing to say. Huh?
No, I seriously believe this. I think neither of you do believe it. So I'm going to refute me.
So Lawrence, tell us, not just a politician, but a government professional, how this hypocrisy and the need for it comes up.
Ah, now that's where it gets very sticky. Because on the one hand, that person will have to, let's say, perform in the role of an advisor. So the government professional will have to advise a leader who is prone to hubris, believing their own press, believing that they're the best thing around since, I don't know, the croissant was invented. You'll have to tell a person
that's
like
John
that.
Edwards, right?
Ooh, steady. No, yeah. You'll have to tell a person like that they should pull back. Maybe they should reconsider giving a speech that they were planning to give. It's going to be very, very difficult. This is why an advisor's position is the most thankless position in the world, but it's the most valuable. You have to tell a person who has started to believe that they can walk on water that in fact they can't, that they're human, that they're going to make terrible mistakes unless they listen to the impartial advice of the advisor.
So you have a fear, I think.
Terrifying.
I mean, the following. I mean, so you want to endorse hypocrisy as a political instrument, but you fear of hypocrisy run amok will have this undermining thing. So you want a modicum of hypocrisy, the right amount of hypocrisy, and you think that some technocratic advisor, special assistant to the president, may have some insight into like how to moderate the hypocrisy that he might otherwise be. Is that a fair summary?
No, of course not. No. Now, it's fair in as far as there has to be an advisor, but it won't be a technocrat. It will, of course, be a political philosopher.
Ah, I see. I see. Well, so a wise person, the professional has to have the kind of wisdom that the politician himself may.
Let me be serious. What I mean, of course, is, and this is exactly why we have all these fabulous professional schools around this part of the world and at Stanford University, teaching ethics to future professionals. You see, they believe my point of view as well. Otherwise, you wouldn't have any of those silly ethics classes, would you?
Yeah. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
My name is David Campbell from Oakland, California. My question picks up where the spectrum question left off. So it goes to a continuum between hypocrisy, and what I heard suggested is the antonym authenticity. Another word, integrity, comes to mind. Can you speak to that range in terms of a person, a position, a decision, where it might lie on the slope, slippery or otherwise?
Let me see if I can pose the questions a little bit differently to Lawrence. So Ken has painted a vision of democracy and authenticity that's very inviting, and hypocrisy would play no part in it. Would you argue with him that in the ideal state there wouldn't be any hypocrisy? Is your point rather that we don't live in the ideal state, and so we have to move further down the spectrum and meet some modicum that makes what's good, democracy, survive in a world that really wasn't designed for it or much of anything else?
I think I'd prefer, I'm going to give you a politician's answer by not actually answering that question. I think I'd prefer to think of the ideal form of democracy that you described as having hypocrisy built into that. And I think we delude ourselves into thinking that we can be transparent, even if it isn't completely, as much as we'd like to be. I mean, self-deception is a very slippery little fellow, and we get involved in that sort of thing all the time. So
look, I agree that what people call white lies are sometimes kind of morally required. Yes. You know, your spouse is wearing some awful thing that she's determined to wear. She asks you, how do I look? You don't say, you look terrible, unless you can actually get her to change. You can say, you look better than this. But if you can't, if it's going to happen, you tell this little white lie. Right, and it seems like a morally good thing. So I can see that there are circumstances in which the whole truth, nothing but the truth, is not the thing. Mm-mm. Right, but what I don't know, I also see that there are circumstances in which truthfulness is the best thing, is required, is morally required. What I'm trying to figure out from you is what there's obviously some balancing thing. Mm. I mean, what principle would you use to figure out how to strike that balance between the permissible bit of hypocrisy, you know, which maybe in an ideal situation we might not require it, and the impermissible bit of hypocrisy that's just, you know. I mean, is there any normative principle that you have in mind to help us balance that?
Certainly. It's what Plato called the oldest virtue, which was moderation. And that's, of course, an extremely difficult virtue to have because I don't think you're born with it. I think it develops over time. I think it is related to developing good judgment. Judgment not merely as a technical skill. Politics, morality, it can't be reduced to algorithms. I know that might be a heresy in Silicon Valley saying something like that, but it can't be.
So right, part of what you think is, I mean, a virtue ethicist think that you can't, right conduct, you know, what's the right thing to do? A certain kind of moral theorist thinks there are rules that determine right conduct. You plug into the circumstances, into the rules, and the rules tell you what the right thing to do is. Mm. The virtue theorist says there aren't any rules. You do what the virtue. It's like having a skill at playing basketball.
How about
you think that a politician needs this skill of navigating the troubled waters of politics?
How about going back to our first example as an analogy, the abolitionist in the Deep South. Any thoughtful person, one might say, any political philosopher, is like that person to a certain extent. They're immersed in a culture that's full of silliness that they have to play along with in order to extract some valuable things that they can promote. Mm. That's the human condition, or that's the condition of intelligent humans. How's that?
I like that. That's quite good. Okay.
And there's no kind of formula we can give them for how to navigate this troubled thing. Well, they just have to have judgment and experience and wisdom or something.
Well, we could probably set up a committee to kind of do an artificial intelligence thing, expert systems. No, I'm a Silicon Valley guy. No, I would definitely, we could do it. Matter of fact, it might be better if we just had one big hypocritical computer that all politicians were forced to get advice from.
Welcome to Philosophy Talks, sir.
My name is Howard Moore. And my question is there a difference between contradiction and hypocrisy? Or is hypocrisy a method of dealing with contradiction?
Mm. That's for you.
No, that's a good question. Maybe hypocrisy is the name that we give to somebody who contradicts themselves. In other words, they're not entirely, internally consistent. So I think you're right. But again, you know, both terms are judgments. And it's very easy to judge other people and their weaknesses. And much harder, it turns out, to judge our own, hence the need for good advice or good friendship, we might say, in private life, if not in public life. But no, I think you're definitely onto something.
Would you say that hypocrisy is a way of avoiding the resolution of contradiction?
It certainly could be in certain instances. If you read the literature on this and the character studies, and there are many wonderful, colorful characters out there who have engaged in hypocrisy over the years, none of us will be surprised to find out, I'm sure. Certainly, to the hypocrite, remaining and appearing consistent to themselves is as important as it is remaining consistent to other people. In fact, it's much easier to fool others sometimes than it is to fool yourself, though not always.
I guess you've already told me there's no formula. I'm kind of getting, though, that it's a complicated thing. It's not like you think hypocrisy fall out, right? But hypocrisy sometimes in the right causes for the right reasons. But you haven't yet told me. I'm going to give you one last chance to tell me. Hypocrisy in the right causes for the right reasons. How measured? How do you measure whether it's the right cause for the right reason?
Oh, tricky. How do you measure it? Let me answer that with an example. We're here in Berkeley, which is wonderful. I love Berkeley, California. It's excellent. Now, Berkeley, California, 2 years ago, apparently had the highest percentage of hybrid cars on the road. Hybrid cars on the road. Now, this is anecdotal now. I don't know if this is scientific, but it's a metric, which is what you're looking for. I have noticed that people that tend to drive hybrid cars tend to drive very poorly. Now, there's good data on this that supports my anecdote, and the data is this, that people, once they've actually exposed themselves to a consumer product, in this case that's green, they do a calculation, so they start to think, well, they paid their dues, literally, and now they can sort of get away with it.
Right.
Right? So it's a tricky business.
Well, on that interesting observation, Lawrence, I'm going to thank you for joining us. It's been a great conversation.
Thank you.
Our guest has been Lawrence Quill. He's a professor of political science at San Jose State University. He's author of the forthcoming book, Secrecy and Democracy. So, John, what are you thinking now? I mean, you surprised me a bit. What are your thoughts on this topic?
Well, mostly that hypocrisy is one of those words in which the definitions you're likely to come up with and your kind of emotive reaction to the use of the word, I'm not sure fit together very well. I think that's an interesting phenomenon. That I'd like to explore more. But we certainly had a guest who's put a lot of thought into it, and it was interesting that he agreed with me and not with you.
Yeah, that definitely. I'm sure you did find that interesting. You know, I'm still not convinced. I mean, I think there can be times when it's expedient to be hypocritical. I think, I don't deny that, but I think there's more to morality and virtue than expediency, and I can't get my head around the idea that hypocrisy is anything other ever than an expedient vice. So I think it's always vicious, but sometimes expedient. But that's life, you know, that's life.
You like my tie?
I love that tie.
Okay.
This conversation continues on our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is cogito ergo blogo. I think, therefore, I blog. You can also find out more by visiting our very active Facebook page, and you can track our tweets on Twitter.
There's a weekly podcast of Philosophy Talk. You can get it for free. You do that by going to our website, philosophytalk.org. And now, we break all campaign promises fast with Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, if hypocrisy is defined as talking one way and acting another, there are other behaviors that are like hypocrisy, but aren't quite. We have mannerisms, affectations, pretensions, ostentations. We put on airs. We exhibit braggadocio, bravado. We jive. We humbug. We bluster. On a more benign level, putting up a brave front is often considered admirable. Her husband is cheating on her, but you wouldn't know it to look at her. He's dying. But look at that smile on his face. There's also the false front, also sometimes considered admirable. The man who hides his shyness with an exuberant, outgoing persona. The clown who's crying on the inside. Hollywood, of course, is the mecca of false fronts. It's where Brooklyn gal Margarita Cancino could become Rita Hayworth. Marian Morrison could become John Wayne. It's where a poor vaudeville stilt walker named Archie Leach could grow up to be super suave Cary Grant. As he himself once said, everybody wants to be Cary Grant. Even I want to be Cary Grant. I lived in Los Angeles for a while and experienced the vagaries of show business firsthand. It's an extremely competitive and stressful place, and yet no outward manifestations of stress are tolerated. It's all right to appear hungry and ambitious, but never desperate. No crying or screaming. These will immediately show up on YouTube. And suddenly, you're the former Mel Gibson. Honing a bland exterior takes a lot of effort. And the strangest thing about LA is that everything is work. Driving is work. Getting a cup of coffee is work. Dinner is work. Working the room is work. But again, you can never make it seem like work. Everything must be sweat-free and casual. I was at a party once with a bunch of show folk. One of them was a very well-known character actor. You've seen him in a zillion things. I just saw him on TV last month playing an FBI agent. I overheard him talking about his audition process. When he went in for audition, he would find out the names of everybody who was going to be or might possibly be there. He would learn about their most recent projects and make it a point to have seen them or at least read reviews. He would learn the names of their spouses and their children, what kind of cars they drove, who they knew in common, if they had pets. And this was long before Google. It probably involved trips to the library, phone calls, clipping items from trade magazines, all for one or maybe two little casual conversation nuggets he could throw into the audition to make himself more memorable. Was he even personally interested in the people he was auditioning for? Well, I think he was, in the same way a salesman is interested in a potential customer. But the whole compliments as currency thing made me a bit queasy, which is why, in case you're wondering, I'm not a big Hollywood star today. But I do remain queasy under a carefully constructed, cheerful facade. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Minella Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University. Copyright 2012.
Our executive producer is David Demarest. Music from Merle Kessler, Amy Kessler, and Joshua Raul Brody, The Playtones.
Special thanks to Eric Blazeski and Stephanie Weissman. Thanks also to Dan Brandon, Caitlin Ash, Merle Kessler, Dave Millar, and Corey Goldman.
The program is produced by Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our Director of Research.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University, the Friends of Philosophy Talk,
and from the members of KALW, Local Public Radio, San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the views of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.